For any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll bring you more coverage from AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference featuring AFGE Air Force Material Command Council 214 President Troy Tingey, Council of Prison Locals Western Region Vice President Michael Meserve, and William Beaumont Army Medical Center Local 2516 President Paul Ferris. But first, we've been joined by Congressman Hank Johnson from Georgia. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
Congressman, you recently penned an op-ed in the Huffington Post arguing that Social Security is not part of the country's financial problems, specifically that it hasn't contributed to our debt or deficit. Tell me more about your position on this.
Well, I mean, it's a clear fact that the Social Security Trust Fund has collected $15.5 trillion since it has been in place. It's only paid out $12.8 trillion. And so it is barred by law from borrowing any money, and the figures show that it does not have to borrow any money. It's solvent, that trust fund, and it will continue to be solvent. And so this is why we don't want to cut Social Security benefits to recipients to bring down the debt. The Social Security Trust Fund did not cause the debt. And so I'm opposed, and many others are opposed to cutting benefits for that reason.
Congressman, why then is Social Security oftentimes included in this national conversation about entitlements that may need to be reformed?
Well, I think that George Bush let the cat out of the bag. They really want to privatize Social Security. They want to see the billions of dollars that go into that trust fund, they want to see it put on Wall Street instead. And that would benefit Wall Street, which has profited handsomely, almost obscenely, over the past few decades. And it's been at the expense of the working people of this country. And so when one retires, one should not have to be subject to the risks that are inherent on Wall Street. And so I'm going to always be opposed to trying to privatize Social Security. And I believe that's what is behind this incessant plea to cut Social Security benefits and this claim that the Social Security Trust Fund is insolvent. It's just not true.
Congressman, you also addressed the three areas that comprise Social Security's revenue. What are they?
You've got three ways that Social Security is collected, or monies that go into this Social Security fund are collected. One is through the tax on the wages of working people, all the way up to $113,700 per year. Anything below that is taxed, and that money goes into the trust fund, the Social Security Trust Fund. Also, when a worker receives the Social Security benefits, they pay a tax on those benefits, and so that puts money back into the Social Security Trust Fund. And then last but not least, you have interest that accrues to the monies in the trust fund. They're not just parked somewhere sitting around not collecting any interest. They are accumulating interest, and so that interest revenue also becomes part of the Social Security Trust Fund.
And so it sounds like you're saying here that while many out there are suggesting that Social Security needs to be reformed or changed, you're essentially saying there's no problem at all.
Yes, that's correct. The system works well, has worked well, and will continue to work well. We don't have to tinker with benefits to current or future recipients of Social Security.
An interesting point in your letter was that Social Security is forbidden by law from borrowing, so it cannot deficit spend. Do you think many people in the general public know this?
No, I don't.
Why is that?
Well, I think that Americans really have to receive a higher level of information than what we tend to get from simply watching TV. And so TV and radio, talk shows, and those kinds of things, those are well and good. You can learn a little something from them, but you really need to read a little deeper and read from a greater number of sources. And that study has to be continuous. Not a lot of people have time for that luxury. And so these are details that are not put out there in the public on a regular basis, and so people just don't know. But it's incumbent upon people to become as educated as they can about the policies that are in place, particularly those policies that help them, the middle class. We've had a lot of middle class people voting against their own interests. It's based on misinformation or lack of good, credible information. And so that's on the people to make sure that they get the information and not depend on just one source for the information.
We're speaking with Congressman Hank Johnson, representing Georgia's 4th District. Congressman, let's talk about the greater good served by Social Security. What does the program mean to average Americans who rely on the program, many of whom this is their sole source of income in retirement?
Yeah, it means that people don't have to work until the day that they die. They will have a minimum income that they can depend on to take care of their food, housing, and clothing, and shelter as they get older. And it's something that people pay for. It's not something that someone is giving to people. No, you work all your life, you pay into the Social Security system, you get your money back out over the balance of your life. So we have a society where elderly people are not poor and dependent upon the largesse of their children. People are able to continue to remain in the middle class as they enter their twilight years. And that's the way that a civilized society like America should make sure that it does for its people. How we treat our elderly and how we treat our young people is how we are defined. And so Social Security is one of the most humane systems in our government. And it's something that we all should be fighting to preserve and protect and enhance.
On the outside, Congressman, we certainly see and hear the way the conversations go about Social Security. But I'm wondering if you can shed some light for us what it's like on the inside, working in the House of Representatives, having those conversations with your colleagues.
Well, a great percentage of my colleagues are across the aisle, and they do not want to talk about the facts, the truth about Social Security. And it's because their leadership leads them to the Wall Street solution. And that is the game plan. The strategy is to talk about how insecure the Social Security Trust Fund is and how it won't be there for younger people. And it's just scaring people with false information. And so you're really not getting much discussion between folks like me and folks on the other side of the aisle who want to cut benefits. This is something that is going to be fought out. And one side is going to win and the other will lose. And I certainly think that we will win this fight to maintain benefits for current and future recipients of Social Security.
The last line of your op-ed reads, "I will work with any congressperson to get this done." Are you hopeful at some point in the future that you may be able to have more fruitful conversations with your colleagues, particularly those who might sit on the opposite side of the aisle?
Yeah, I am always optimistic about the future, and always have a positive attitude towards the dialogue that we need to have. Unfortunately, there is a strategy on the other side to not have dialogue. It's a my way or the highway mentality. And so while you can be positive and talk until you're blue in the face, you're not getting anywhere with that kind of obstinance. And so when the Republicans decide to change that strategy and to become more involved in trying to get things done here in Congress, let's stop the gridlock and let's work on solutions to all of the challenges that we face. When we get to that point, I will be gratified, and I will welcome the dialogue and the different ideas that come to the fore, as long as we're in good faith trying to hash out our differences.
Lastly, Congressman, as a member of the House Armed Services Committee, what are your thoughts on all of the talk around Washington about sequestration?
Well, sequestration is definitely going to be a pain if it should pass. It will be actually greater than a pain. It will be a devastating hit to our economy. It will throw our economy back into a recession, and it will cost a lot of jobs, and both in government and in the business community that relies upon the wages of government workers in order to survive. And it will also hurt the defense portion of the budget. It'll hurt our security because it calls for a 10% across-the-board cut on all accounts. Every facet of government spending would take a 10% whack, and it's very disruptive in terms of being able to plan for government responsibilities. It's just something that no one wants to see happen around here, just a base 10% cut in government. That's not a good way to run a government. If you're going to have cuts, cuts should be targeted. But I will tell you that we've cut over $1 trillion from the budget, $1.2 trillion or $1.4 trillion, whichever one is the case. We've cut, and we've only raised about $700-800 billion in revenue. So we have a lot more closing of tax loopholes and fair tax assessment for the corporate community, which has not been paying its fair share. The corporate community and the wealthy, the top 2%, they've not been paying their fair share. And that needs to change. We need to have their investment in this country's future. And we all know that we need to pay down our debt, but it should not be on the backs of the middle class and the poor.
Congressman Hank Johnson, representing Georgia's 4th District. Congressman, it was a real pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you for coming to see us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll take you back to AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference with Air Force Material Command Council 214 President Troy Tingey.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, SeaWorld, and Universal Studios? And if you enjoy winter activities, take advantage of discount lift tickets for New England ski resorts. These are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. AFGE also offers members a host of other valuable benefits, from scholarships and insurance to discounts on computers, appliances, health clubs, and more. AFGE is the largest and most influential federal and D.C. government employee union in the United States. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Go to AFGE.org and click on the Join AFGE Today button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Troy Tingey, the president of AFGE's Local 1592, as well as Council 214. Troy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Troy, many challenges your folks are faced with now, with reduction in staffing, threats of sequestration looming, of course. Tell me the latest in how you're handling those situations.
We're kind of in the dark as the rest of the world. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we're doing some PDI, pre-decisional involvement with AFMC. And actually, we've come up with some ideas. We've kicked around how we're going to give the folks their furloughs. You know, they're talking about 22 days off. And we've decided that we want to do it 22 days straight. And the reason we want to do that is because a lot of these states, you know, we're going to be able to collect unemployment. We want the states to feel this. We want people to get attention. And I think that that's going to help it. When they furlough 9,000 people at Hill and that unemployment line goes down and around the block a few times, somebody's going to pay attention.
Talk to me about the impact of furloughing somebody for 22 days straight. How would that affect the public service?
Well, think about it. 22 days, and you're going to tell America that one of their prestige bases, Hill Air Force Base, is shut down. There goes your defense. For 22 days, you're vulnerable. And if we can do this across the command, we're talking Warner Robins, Wright-Patterson, Tinker, Kirtland, a few other bases. Across, I mean, public ain't going to put up with that kind of stuff. You're going to say, hey, where's our defense? What's going to happen?
I think you bring up a really great point, and that is many times when these decisions are being made and the public is unaware of the true impact on them, this highlights how service is impacted by the work that federal employees do, or in this case, aren't allowed to do.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, some people will still be working, but we're not sure who. But when you take the mechanics off the aircraft and we're not supporting the warfighter, it's going to have a huge impact. And people's going to notice, people's going to feel it, community's going to feel it. Just something that we want to make sure that everybody hears it. You know, you hear about the government employee, how we have it made and whatnot. We've, to my knowledge, J. David Cox said $127 billion is what we paid into this cuts, towards their budget cuts. We've had enough. We want our payback. We don't want a day here and a day there. We want it all at once, and we want people to recognize it.
It's obvious the mission of the federal employee, and that is one to serve the country. How's the morale at Hill around these circumstances?
It's low and gloom. You know, you got single families out there that are wondering how they're going to be able to make that car payment, how they're going to be able to put the shoes on the kids and make sure that they're living that good life that they've been living. And they're in the dark. They're not sure exactly what's going to happen to them. So they're relying on us to do something. I mean, they're flat out. They're saying, union, what you going to do? How you going to protect us here? And how are we going to stop this?
And this clearly is a national issue, something that people are dealing with from coast to coast. What impact are you able to have as the president of Local 1592 and Council 214?
Well, a bigger impact is the council president, because like I mentioned, them other bases that we're going to have an effect on. So it's going to have a big effect when we shut down those depots for 22 days. But you're right, it's across the board. I mean, Social Security, the veterans, all these agencies are going to be furloughed. Nobody's really safe.
Speaking of the other agencies, you mentioned SSA and the VA. How are you working with your brothers and sisters across AFGE to sort of fight back against these initiatives?
Well, we're sharing each other's ideas. We're kicking it around. We want to make sure we protect the people who's going to really have an impact on you get those wage grade threes or those GS threes that aren't making a lot of money. We're trying to figure out how we're going to be able to protect them as well and keep them safe and still make that house payment.
You mentioned the salary levels, wage grade three, GS three. This is something that many people across the board in America don't understand. There's a clear conflict there because they're talking about federal employees having it made, making six-figure salaries, but you're saying to me, GS-3, that's who's impacted by this.
Absolutely. You know, $9, $10, $12 an hour jobs there. You know, the only three digits that I know of any government employees and people up on Congress. And you know, they say, well, we're going to take the cut and pay also. But what the public doesn't know is they might take the cut and pay, but they're going to pass a bill that they get paid later on. Whereas the GS-3s and the wage grade 3s that I talk about may or may not get paid, so it's going to have a huge impact on them. And it trickles down. Might not be able to buy so much gas that day or take the spouse out to dinner. Or, you know, community's going to feel that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Troy Tingey, the president of AFGE's Local 1592 and Council 214. Troy, you bring up a really good point about the local economy impact. There's also an impact on the long-term cycle of the federal employee's career, because if they're making less now, that's going to impact the amount that they have in their pension plans down the road, right?
Absolutely. The high three, high five, whatever the flavor of the week is, it's just like overtime. You get that extra money when you're doing it for overtime for your high three. It leave without pay is going to have an impact on their career. And if the sad part is if they get away with a furlough today, furloughs and sequestration is nothing new. We know that. If they get away with it this year, who knows what's going to happen in the years to come. And when they start furloughing people, the contractors are still going to be working, which brings up another point. They're going to be breaking the 50-50 rule. Once our people are off, 50-50 rule is going to be breached.
Explain that 50-50 rule for our audience who might not be familiar with it.
Well, it's a rule that I don't think anybody can actually give you an explanation, but the way I understand it is 50% organic, 50% in-house, so to speak. So 50% of the work that can actually be contracted out can be done by 50% contractors and 50% government employees, but it's got to be a certain workload, and that's the definition that I can't define for you. I don't know if anybody actually can.
It sounds like a difficult situation, to be sure. Talk to me about the differences between being a contractor and being a federal employee.
Well, I guess the biggest difference is benefits. We have contractors that are standing in line to become government employees. Sure, they might make a little more money than the guy that they're working to or the lady next to them, but their benefits are a little bit different. They don't get that annual and sick leave, and the health care is probably not the same. But not only that, their mission, it's crucial. We understand that. I mean, we have CFTs, contract field teams, for a reason. Spike workload, for example. But today, contractor may be working at Hill. Tomorrow, contractor may be working at Tinker versus a civil servant. You know, at least they could put a mailbox up and stay home.
And there's also something involving the oath that federal employees have to take before they start service, right?
Absolutely. And that oath is to protect the public at all costs.
Troy, what brought you to the labor movement?
Well, things like this, you know, to make sure that people are protected, not stepped on, the rights are not violated, and to keep government as honest as we can.
When you look back on your career, what stands out to you the most as a significant accomplishment?
I can't narrow it down, but somebody said something to me one day. They said, you know what, Tingey? Things that you do impact people that never know you, never will ever know you. And you impact a lot of lives out there at Hill and across the nation when you fight for their rights. And what you do, we believe in, and we appreciate what you do. And we'd be more than happy to send you back there to Washington to work them people over. So it's not one huge compliment. It's just what we do overall.
And we certainly appreciate everything that you do here within AFGE and the labor movement. Certainly your presence is known and appreciated.
And we appreciate you as well.
Troy Tingey, the president of AFGE's Local 1592 and Council 214. Troy, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue from AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference with Council of Prison Locals, Western Region Vice President Michael Meserve.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand-name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Michael Meserve, the Western Region Vice President for AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jason.
This week, of course, is AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference, and you have a unique relationship with the member of Congress in your district in which you work. Talk to me a little bit about the advantages that you have of working with someone who supports your issues.
Yes, I'd be happy to. Colleen Hanabusa is the congresswoman who represents Congressional District 1, which is the city of Honolulu and the surrounding the metropolitan area and some of the suburban areas outside of the city proper. One of the most exciting things about working in her district, working in the city of Honolulu, Honolulu is first and foremost a union city, a very proud union city. It is also an extremely diverse city. And Colleen is one of the strongest union advocates that I have worked with so far out of the elected representatives for the state of Hawaii. Her background, going back over 30 years, is in labor advocacy. She went to law school, got her law degree in labor law, and practiced as a labor attorney for quite an amount of time before then getting elected into the Hawaii State Legislature. She became the majority leader in the Hawaii State Senate, and then she became the first woman in state history to be elected to the position of the president of the Hawaii State Senate. All of that prior to her getting elected to her seat in Congress now, which was previously held by Neil Abercrombie.
So it's clear that she is in a position to help and also understands your issues. When you talk to her about some of these things, what's the response that you get?
Right away, as soon as you start a conversation with Colleen, when you're talking about the needs of labor, including the needs of federal sector labor, she gets it. You can tell immediately that she understands all of the ins and outs of the needs of a workforce, the rights of employees, the importance of a strong and well-represented workforce. You don't really have to take her to school on anything. You don't need to give her any kind of labor union 101 dialogue. From the front end of the conversation, she knows exactly where we're coming from and what our needs are, and she absolutely knows what all of our challenges are and what we're up against. So you can get right to the heart of the issue right away in a dialogue with her.
Let's talk about some of those needs and challenges. Now, I know that in the Bureau of Prisons, you all are essentially unarmed, and you're oftentimes supervising as many as 150 inmates by yourself, and that's usually on a good day. Talk to me about some of the challenges that being a correctional officer working in the Federal Bureau of Prisons presents.
Well, you're absolutely right. We're at any moment, we are vastly outnumbered. by the inmate population. And we often say within the federal prison system that the only reason why at any given moment that we're maintaining control of the facility is because the inmates are allowing us to. Because if they're outnumbering a staff member, 150 to 1, they could, if they had the mind to, take control at any moment. They choose, most of the time, they choose to stay compliant and to cooperate with our agenda and our mission. But it's that fraction of 1% of the time that they don't, that creates really frightening scenarios that we hear about. They pop up really, not daily, but at least weekly, several times a month around the country. We have very dangerous scenarios that occur in which staff members are harmed in some way.
And I think it's important to note at this point that we're talking about convicted felons, many of whom are incarcerated because of violent offenses.
Yes. Over time, the inmate population has very drastically shifted. Just even in the last 10 years, we have a much younger, much more aggressive inmate population than we've ever had before historically. A lot of that has to do with the way the laws have shifted. Congress tends to, they only ever add to Title 18, which is U.S. Criminal Code. They never subtract from it. So it's like building a brick wall. The wall just keeps getting more complex and higher as new bricks are added to that wall. Even if they realize, even if Congress comes to the realization that they've gone too far with something that they've federally criminalized, or by increasing mandatory minimum sentences, by increasing sentencing enhancements, let's say adding an automatic 20 years to someone's sentence for doing something within 1,000 feet of a playground or school, even if they realize they've overstepped, no one is going to introduce a bill to roll it back to the way it was before, to a more sane level of criminal code, because then their opponent will use that against them to say that they're weak on crime in a future election. So even the most progressive members of Congress are reluctant to try to roll any of that back.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Michael Meserve, the Vice President of the Western Region for the Council of Prison Locals here at AFGE. Mike, what then is the impact on you all as staff? We know what the laws mean for offenders, but there's also a trickle-down effect for an agency that is very clearly understaffed and underfunded.
Yes, we're currently, the most recent number I saw, and this was in a congressional report that came out very recently. Right now, the Bureau of Prisons has about 3,200 vacant correctional officer positions nationwide. Meanwhile, the inmate population consistently increases annually by around 6,000 or 7,000 inmates above what the population was at the previous year. And that's even though we're releasing inmates, on average, let's say, I think in 2012 we released about 60,000 inmates, yet our total population increased by over 7,000 inmates. So we brought in nearly 70,000 after releasing 60,000 over the course of the year. And that's consistent. And in order to safely manage that ever-increasing inmate population, we would have to build and activate and staff at least 4 to 6 new federal prisons every year. That's not occurring. So the hiring of new staff, new correctional officers, is not happening at any kind of rate close to the increase in federal prison population. We're also not building facilities. They're constructed and open very, very slowly. There's one in my home state of where I'm originally from, New Hampshire, in Berlin, New Hampshire. They were trying to open it in 2008, and through budget cuts, problems getting our building and facilities budget through Congress and signed into law, signed by the president, we ended up delaying and delaying and delaying opening the prison. They're just now receiving their first inmates at that facility now, 5 years later. That's how long it takes to try to get these new prisons open and funded appropriately and staffed, to hire the staff to run them.
Take me through some of your legislative priorities for 2013 to address and fix these issues.
We've actually been, for some time, we've actually been endorsing bills that would go back to older sentencing guidelines. Once upon a time, judges had a lot more flexibility in sentencing. But then a lot of these things were event-driven. So Congress got involved, took more and more sentencing authority away from judges, put in a system of mandatory minimum sentencing into place, regardless of the circumstances of the crime, regardless of the rehabilitation potential of the inmate. They must do a mandatory minimum sentence, so they have to be kept inside prison longer. The same thing with what I mentioned earlier with sentencing enhancements. Those have been added into federal law by Congress to keep people inside longer. They took away what we called old law, good time accrual. Inmates used to be able to, by being on good behavior while they were inside, they would accrue good time that allowed for an earlier release as long as they were behaving themselves and complying with the rules of our system. If they misbehaved as a disciplinary action, they could lose their good time that they had accrued. And it was a very effective inmate management tool to keep inmates in line and complying with the rules while they were inside serving their time. Congress changed that. So now there's very little opportunity for inmates to accrue good time to reward their good behavior while serving time, the fact that they're getting their GED, that they're participating in drug treatment programs, anger management programs, financial management programs. They used to be able to use those tools to leverage an earlier release. They can no longer do that the way they could. Sheila Jackson Lee from Houston, in the last three sessions of Congress, had introduced a bill to go back to the old good time accrual system, and it doesn't go anywhere. It gets stuck in committee because I think members of Congress are reluctant to support a bill that appears to be soft on crime or soft on inmates. So inmates are being held longer, which means they hold up bed space. We're currently running just over 40% overcrowded nationwide in the federal prison system. At our high security facilities, which is where we need bed space the most desperately, we're running around 50% overcrowded, meaning that our high security prisons are housing 50% more inmates than they were designed to hold, which is, it's a pressure cooker it's a very dangerous scenario to continue to pack, in some cases, dangerous felons into prisons much in excess of the design capacity for that facility.
Mike, organizing obviously is the lifeblood of a successful union, something that the Council of Prison Locals has done quite well at over the years. Talk to me about that solidarity.
I think part of the success of our ability to organize comes from the fact that on a daily basis, we're fighting a war on two fronts, really, as employees in our agency. On the one hand, we have an inmate population, a very dangerous, potentially dangerous inmate population. They don't like us very much. And even though we try to tell them, we didn't put you here, and we're just supposed to watch you while you're here and keep you from harm while you're here and make sure that you stay inside and you don't get out back into society for however long it's been determined you must be kept away from society. At the same time, though, they can't help but associate us directly with their confinement. And so one of my coworkers, he said it best. He says it's a hate factory. Any prison system is a hate factory. The inmates can't really help but hate you because they associate you with their confinement. On the other side of the battlefront. We have a very poorly managed agency. The administration side of the Federal Bureau of Prisons is not, definitely not a model of the right way to run a federal agency. And so we're constantly, as bargaining employees and as union leaders, we're constantly at odds with the administration of our agency. And so because we have these adverse conditions on two sides of us, it tends to make us put all of our petty differences aside and watch each other's back and to really look out for one another. And I think that's the secret, really, to the success of how organized we are. My home local in Honolulu, Hawaii, is generally about 94% organized. For years in a row, we've won the highest organization percentage in the western region of my agency. But it's easy to do. Well, it's in Honolulu, it's easy because, as I said earlier, Honolulu is absolutely a union city. But also, the line staff understand that the inmates are against us. The administration of the agency does not very often seem to act in our best interest. Very few employees feel like the agency truly cares about them and their safety. So they look to the union for that. They look to the union for that protection for someone who truly cares about them.
Mike Meserve, the Western Region Vice President for AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Mike, great to have you on the program today. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue from AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference with William Beaumont Army Medical Center Local 2516 President Paul Ferris.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program. It offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program's administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office. It's handled more than 700 cases since 2005 and won millions of dollars in back pay for its members. In each of the last 2 years alone, AFGE attorneys have brought in more than $1 million in attorney's fees. Their attorneys are experienced litigators and committed to the best possible representation. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit Systems Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For more information about the program, please call 202-639-6424. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined here by Paul Ferris, the president of AFGE's Local 2516 out of El Paso, Texas. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. You did forget one thing, El Paso, Texas. The safest city in America.
Paul, we are here today at AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference 2013. What are the top issues that you're looking to take to Capitol Hill this week?
In a nutshell, taking America. Our issues have to deal with America. We talk about pay, the sequestration, the budget, but it's really about taking care of America. And we as federal employees do that. And that's a topic that we need to address and have our legislators look at this in a serious manner of we, not me, and forget the self-interest.
Along the lines of sequestration and potential furloughs, where do you stand on that and how would that impact your members in Texas?
Oh, tremendously. And not just the members. Remember, if there's one less dollar in a federal employee's pocket, is one less dollar to the church that they donate to. To the missions, to the food for the hungry, to the guy on the street corner needing a buck. It affects everybody. And then, of course, if you have no money coming in, you pay no taxes. So if you pay no taxes, you increase your budget deficit.
So how do we go about solving this problem?
We sit down and talk. We try to find an answer together for both of us. I called Senator Cornyn's office. I tried to get an appointment. I was very blunt with them. I said, look, I know the senator's position, hates unions, not real crazy about federal employees. I don't care. I'm a union guy. I'm an American. We're representing Americans. We're taking care of American soldiers. And we need to sit down and talk. We need to dialogue and come to something for the we and not me.
That's interesting, your perspective on this, especially when you were calling someone from the other side of the aisle. What was it like reaching out to someone on the other side of the aisle who didn't share your opinion, but you were looking to work with to find common ground?
To me, it's easy. If somebody has a flat tire, you don't drive by and say, Republican, Democrat, form, they need help. You help them. And I look at it this way, that one time I might need help. Am I going to turn it away because they are of a different party or different belief? We have to work together. This is the United States of America, United States of America. So it's easy for me to so-called cross over, but it's not crossing over. It's just simply talking to those people, having a dialogue, and usually when someone doesn't want to talk to you, they're afraid of the unknown.
What are you hoping to come out of this situation if you're able to get an opportunity to reach across the aisle and talk to someone?
I think I'll show them what they're doing. Bring them back to the grassroots. Bring them to the ground that we're at and show them what happens when you cut medical services for our veterans and our active duty. We represent all the medical staff at William Beaumont Army Medical Center. So if we're short one doctor, one psychiatrist, one psychologist, these are people's lives. So not just will it affect dollars and cents, what happens when the guy is not healthy to be out on the streets because we wanted to fight backroom politics? So it affects everybody.
As you're going up, making your way to Capitol Hill and discussing these issues with legislators, what's the first thing that you bring up?
Are you an American? Do you care about our country? I go to the heart. I believe in telling it like it is. I was on a program that I was coming back and forth to Washington, D.C., and I made a mistake. Well, not really a mistake. I was just honest. We had some big shots from Capitol Hill telling us it was supposed to be a management union joint venture working together on a project. And the director of one of the departments said that she was going to go forward and tell everybody how the union and management came together. And she had never been in any of the meetings. And the management and union had been coming together and working together. And I stood up and I said, ma'am, with all due respect, I don't know how you do things in D.C., but in El Paso, Texas, we tell the truth, and that's not the truth. The union hasn't bought off on this. The management hasn't bought off on this. We are still working together on this. And until that happens, please do not put our name on anything. So when we say these things, it's about telling the truth and being straight up and working for what's right. And when we go in to talk to these congressmen and the senators, it's about doing what's right for this country and telling the truth to them, not what they want to hear or what a special interest wants to be said.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Paul Ferris, the president of AFGE's Local 2516 in El Paso, Texas. Paul, take me inside your facility at the William Beaumont Army Medical Center.
You go through the front door on the third floor, and you go in, and the halls just speak to you. We have an annex named after General Omar Bradley, the last living five-star. I remember when he was there walking the halls. Then as you walk through, you'll see ladies and gentlemen wearing hats that say World War II veteran, Korea, Vietnam, Iraqi war veteran, Afghanistan. It's amazing. And now with our new commander, Colonel Hummel, he is very pro-employee. Now, I use the word employee and union interchangeable. If you're anti-union, you're anti-employee. If you're pro-employee, you're pro-union. He is working together with the union to do the right things, make sure our staffing levels are correct, make sure our employees are able to do the job they're supposed to do, make sure that the rights that are legally there are followed. So it's a great place. We have heroes. I often tell our staff members, we're no better than the outside medical facilities. We do the same job as them, start IVs, shots, surgeries. But the difference is we're taking care of American heroes, those who paint the flag, those who are part of that flag, part of America. And we have to remember that that's a different level, and a lot of expectations are on us and responsibility as federal employees.
What's the staffing level like at your facility?
We're getting there. We can always use more staff. We're trying to work more efficiently because we know we have to downsize. We're crossing over, but there's a process with the unions and the laws. There's a process in cross-training to make sure people's skills are appropriate when you do other jobs or other duties as assigned.
Talk to me about how a deficient staffing level would impact the operations at your facility.
Dangerous. If we don't have the proper staffing caused by the sequestration, by the budget cuts, because the pencil pushers up in D.C. don't know how to get their act together, we're talking about people on the streets that need to be cared for, that might not get its surgery, that may need mental health taken care of. And this is dangerous, not just locally, but when you're out on the street, most of the time, somebody else, the innocent person, is going to be affected.
When you hear talk of disparaging federal employees, denigrating them, putting them in the political conversation almost as a football, how does that make you feel?
Upset. Walk a mile in my shoes. The federal sector at Beaumont Hospital, the employees are dedicated. They're veterans, combat veterans, family members of active duty, retirees. We've walked the walk, we've talked the talk, and people that are saying that we don't do our job haven't been there. As with any organization, you have those who could do better, and that's what we're striving for in this economic hard times, is we have to strive to make sure that everybody's game is brought up another notch.
What's one myth about federal employees that you would like to dispel here today?
They're lazy. They're not. Federal employees will go above the mile. All you have to do is ask them. Whatever you need, they will do it. And that's a big difference between a contractor. A contractor has specific jobs that you pay for. You go outside that, you're going to pay more money. It's a travesty to hear, we're going to cut the government, then you raise the debt by hiring more contractors. That's crazy, but it looks good on the numbers. So it's a shame. It's a shame we do those kind of things.
Talk to me about that relationship between contractor and federal employee.
All federal employees raise their arm, their hand, and take an oath to this nation. Contractors don't. They sign a check. That is a major difference. When you ask a contractor to do this or that, or you want to change something, it's in a contract. They have to move it. Cost you money. Federal worker, hey, can you do this? Sure, absolutely, not a problem. I can help you out. Can you do this? Well, I really don't know how, but I'll be glad to help you out. We work to accomplish the mission. It's not about the money. It's about helping America.
As you look forward to 2013 and beyond, what are you hoping to accomplish for your local?
To keep employed, to bring back the pride that we have and make the American people realize that we must take care of federal employees, which include our military. Without that, we don't have the freedoms that we have. We don't have the opportunities to speak out like we have. We need to be taking care of our soldiers, and to do that, you need people who have been there, done that, and understand our heroes.
Paul Ferris, the president of AFGE's Local 2516 in El Paso, Texas, the William Beaumont Army Medical Center. Paul, great to see you here this week. Thanks for coming by to see us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to our guest this week, Congressman Hank Johnson from Georgia, AFGE Air Force Material Command, Council 214 President Troy Tingey, Council of Prison Locals Western Region Vice President Michael Meserve, and William Beaumont Army Medical Center Local 2516 President Paul Ferris. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. WFED.